Blog Talk. Hello and welcome to the November 13th, 2011 edition of Don't Let It Go Unheard. It's the podcast devoted to the discussion of news and politics from the perspective of Ayn Rand's philosophy, Objectivism. I'm your host, Amy Peikoff, and here are the topics I have planned today. First, Herman Cain is well known as the 999 man. Well, here I have some new numbers that are relevant to him and in particular the sexual harassment allegations that he's been facing in the last couple weeks. How about 5 times 0 equals 0? What do I mean by that? Stay tuned and we'll talk about that. Second, why does everyone care so much about what a cartoonist has to say about Occupy Wall Street? We'll discuss what Frank Miller has said about the movement this week and why everyone is so upset about it. Third, a bunch of stuff on politics, because we had not one but 2 GOP debates to entertain and depress us this week. I'll give you some of the highlights and the lowlights, and we'll discuss 2012 voting strategies that are being floated out there. And then there's another provision of Obamacare, yet another provision that is troublesome, very troublesome, and perhaps unconstitutional. It's the subject of a current litigation challenge, so we'll discuss that briefly. And if we have time, the scandal at Penn State. Coaching legend Joe Paterno is fired, and many people seem to be more upset about that than about the sexual abuse that he helped to cover up. Before we dive in, some logistics. There's a couple of ways for you who are attending live to interact with me. The first is that you can call in at 760-888-5817. That's 760-888-5817 and talk with me live. The other way is through the chat room, and I see a bunch of people are hanging out in the chat room, so you can type brief comments, questions, et cetera there. Okay, so let's go ahead and start right in. I know a lot of people, I think, wanted to talk about the Frank Miller thing, but we're going to tease you a little bit. I feel it's important to talk a little bit about epistemology, believe it or not. So we're not going to be quite as bad as someone on Fox News like Greta Van Susteren. We'll watch her show sometimes, and she'll tease the topic that everybody wants to talk about over and over through segment after segment, and you say, come on, why can't you just get to the John Bolton interview or whatever it is?
And then it's never what she intended.
Yeah. It's always a letdown by the time you get to that as well, right? We don't have Frank Miller to interview, by the way. If Frank Miller ever wants to call in and talk to a sympathetic audience, he's welcome to call in. But as far as I know, we don't have Frank Miller here. We are not advertising that. So if that's what you're waiting for, sorry about that. We will talk about what he had to say and ask for your reaction to it. And Bosch has a few words to say about him as well, because he has been an admirer of Miller for many years. But like I said before that, a little bit of epistemology. We are talking about Herman Cain. We actually did have the privilege of meeting Herman Cain this week early on Monday at a private event. We got to shake hands with him, no substantive conversation, you know, just the usual handshake, you know, thank you for being brave enough to run. We had a little bit of interaction with Mark Block, the smoking guy.
Chief of staff.
Yeah, he's the Herman Cain's chief of staff. And Bosch had done a cartoon.
Which he actually saw.
Yeah, he had seen it before he met us. And then we got a cool picture of Bosch with Mark Block, where Mark Block had made a point of making sure he took out a fresh cigarette
and lit it up.
It was blowing smoke in the
That's
picture.
So,
so yeah, so that was quite a lot of fun. But here, in terms of the epistemology lesson that we need to talk about, it has to do with the sexual harassment allegations against Herman Cain. As many people know, I think 5 different women have come forward and said that there was some sort of bad interaction that they had with him, or maybe there were sexual harassment charges filed. In some cases, yes, in some cases, no. I don't know the story on all of the 5, but there was, and I actually had intended to talk about this anyway, and then I came across a nice little blog piece by Michael Hurd, and he wrote a piece and published it on the 9th of November this week. It's Conservatives Have to Prove Negatives but liberals don't.
Yeah.
And in this piece, he's talking about the same epistemological point that I wanted to discuss. So let me give you a little bit of his introduction. He says, everyone, Republicans and Democrats alike, keeps saying that, quote, Herman Cain must answer the charges against him, end quote. And we've heard that all through the week. When he repeatedly says, I didn't do it, I don't even remember these interactions with these women, then this is not considered answering. But the question is, how is one to prove a negative? How is one supposed to prove that one is not guilty of something? If someone walked up to you and said, you killed my brother, you'd be shocked. You know, what you'd say, what are you talking about? How dare you make such an accusation? What's going on here? Imagine if you were put on trial for breaking a law and your lawyer was informed, quote, your client must prove he didn't do it. The burden of proof is on him, end quote. Now, this, of course, would be the antithesis of rationality, and it's what has always been the uniquely American form of justice, right? Usually we say that the burden of proof is on the accuser. It's not on the person who was the accused. But not so when it comes to sexual harassment. At least when a conservative, especially a black conservative, this is Heard writing, is accused of it, the onus of proof is on the one being accused. And I think he's probably also referring back to the case of Clarence Thomas, where he also had to disprove sexual harassment claims. You know, particularly in the realm of sexual harassment, there seems to be an allowance for what in epistemology we refer to as the arbitrary. Okay, there's really three categories of knowledge. There's things that are true, there's things that are false, and then there's things that are arbitrary. Now, there's other categorizations as well along, you know, the way to getting to be true. There is, just, you know, the saying that there is something possible. You could also say along the way to proving that something is true that something is probable, right? So there's different categories that you put an assertion into depending on how much evidence you have to support it. So if you have some evidence, you could say it's possible. If you have a lot of evidence such that it's more likely than not that it's true, you'll say it's probable. And if you have evidence such that everything points towards it being true and you know of no evidence that points towards it being false, you've got adequate evidence to explain and prove a particular assertion, then you could say you are certain within a context of knowledge. But here what we're dealing with is we are dealing with assertions that, unless there's some evidence to back them up, are arbitrary. And arbitrary is the classification that you would give to an assertion if there is no evidence behind it. So, for example, some people were saying that they're having a hard time. They had to reload the page in order to get on the show. So suppose I say, well, the reason that you had that trouble is because there are green gremlins that work for Blog Talk Radio, and they happen to not like my show, and so they wanted to make it harder for people to listen to my show. How about that?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Five green gremlins, says Bosch. So prove that there aren't. Now, if I don't give you actual evidence of the green gremlins, you've never heard of gremlins, you never heard of green gremlins, right? It's arbitrary. It's completely arbitrary. Similarly, I think that there are sexual harassment claims in which there is either no real evidence or very little evidence, sometimes no evidence other than the woman said that such and such happened, right? So here we are, we're dealing with cases in which we know something about a candidate, namely Herman Cain. We've gotten some idea of what he's like watching him debate after debate after debate, all these endless debates every week, right? We're getting some impression of him. We've seen him maybe on interviews. Maybe we got lucky and we shook his hand at an event. And then there's women we've never heard of before. We don't know anything about them. And they make these assertions that he's engaged in improper conduct with respect to them. Now, their accusations, their assertions are some evidence, right? Because, I mean, you've got a person who's saying XYZ happened, so that's some evidence. But the question is the evidence credible? If you're in a situation where the only evidence that a certain thing occurred is the eyewitness testimony of one person, even if that person is the alleged victim, really what you're looking at is the credibility of the particular evidence, which is why if there's no evidence other than the assertion of the woman herself, that's why her credibility, her character becomes relevant. And that's the situation whenever you've got, say, in a court of law, the only evidence that a certain thing occurred, you know, that you're using to prove a case, if the only evidence is eyewitness testimony, sometimes they will impeach the witness, right? So this is something that's relevant to do. Now, if you discredit a witness and that witness's testimony is the only thing, the only piece of evidence in favor of a certain allegation, then you've wiped out the only evidence that exists and you're back in the situation of the arbitrary, right? You're back in the situation where there is actually no evidence in favor of a particular allegation being true. And so you're actually asking somebody to prove a negative. So really the only thing that Herman Cain can do in his defense, if the only evidence against him is an assertion, a testimony of one person, the only thing he can do is discredit that witness, because that's the only evidence that's being offered. So this is why I say if there are five allegations, but none of them are shown to have any merit to them at all, if you can discredit all the witnesses, or if none of them are coming forward with anything substantive to back up their claims, then the fact that you've got five of them doesn't make it any better. It's still 5 times 0, and that's why I say 5 times 0 equals 0. Now, in the particular case here, like I said, we know something about Herman Cain. Some people like him. Some people maybe don't like him. I tend to like him. I tend to wish that he was a lot stronger in certain, elements of knowledge. I think he's got a decent method that he wants to come at the problems that might face him as president. But in terms of his concrete knowledge, I wish he would step it up a bit more. In terms of these women who have come out as accusers against him, we don't know them. We would need to see some more evidence if they have been shown to be of doubtful credibility, because that's all that we have to go on at this point is the fact that they said something. Some people tweeted out this week, they said, oh, well, you know, it's not just he said, she said, it's he said, she said, she said, she said, she said, she said, because there's five she's. But if it's only she said and all the she's are deemed to be not credible, it's still, like I said, 5 times 0 equals 0.
How many people say Islam means peace?
Oh, a whole bunch of them. But 50 million Frenchmen can't be wrong, right? No, actually they can. But you have to look at the substance of each of the claims. And the fact that there's five of them doesn't make it any better if there's nothing to any of them. So you do have to look at the substance of the claim. There's two accusers that I've learned something about through the news over the week. One of them works for Obama and had some workplace claims in the past. So it was thought that this is kind of the way she deals with conflict in the workplace. And so there's some question being cast on her testimony. And then the other one who made the big press conference with Gloria Allred, her name is Bialik, I think is her last name. I just recently saw a news story that said that she was fired from the National Restaurant Association because she had made false sex harassment allegations. Something else I saw this week is that she apparently allowed to be out there unchallenged the idea that she was living with this guy that she had been engaged to, some fiancé who was supposedly in support of her claim, in support of her going out there. But it turns out the poor guy, she moved out from living with him months ago, and he's in desperate hope, as far as I can tell, of her coming back to him. And I think that's why he is supporting her in these allegations. So the whole thing seems like I haven't really seen any real evidence. I did hear that these five women were supposed to get together and have a joint press conference. Right. And so that, they said, well, maybe each of us apart, there's nothing, but if we all get together and have this joint press, but I haven't seen the press conference happen. So I need to see more evidence. I haven't seen, as far as I can tell, any credible evidence that Herman Cain has done anything wrong with respect to these allegations. And unless I do, then I'm still in the 5 times 0 equals 0 position. Especially today, charges of sexual harassment can be filed, I think, fairly arbitrarily. You go to the particular human resource manager and, maybe file the claim, and you might still get a nominal award. They've talked about nominal damage awards in the tens of thousands, and you could still get that probably without putting forth very little evidence. So the fact that there was a claim filed doesn't necessarily mean anything. We need to know more of the substance. So Dr. Hurd, what he writes here is, I think, true. He says, what's a Republican voter to do about Herman Cain? People should file these accusations away, but not make too much of them when deciding whether or not to vote for him. He says, I'm not defending Cain's political views. Although I like the man compared to other politicians, not saying much, his proposal of adding new taxes without confronting the problem of massive government spending is foolish at best, will never pass, and could not work even if it did. He says, I have no vested interest or desire in seeing him win, but I certainly don't want to see him lose because he's accused of something which nobody can ever prove. Even Bill Clinton ran into trouble, not for sexual harassment per se, but because he was caught lying in sworn testimony, which made him guilty of perjury, end quote, from Michael Hurd. So we've got here in the chat room, Deborah says, Bialik has a long record of mischief, multiple bankruptcies, etc. And there is a link there in the chat room for you. It's at canetruth.com. So I think you can go find it there. Now, Ryan here says, I'm much more concerned about Cain's lack of foreign policy knowledge. How about the video where he says the Chinese are developing nuclear weapons? Yeah, we'll talk about foreign policy. Actually, that particular piece of information didn't come out in the foreign policy debate last night. But yes, I agree there. Now, Michael says Cain wasn't a plausible threat to the establishment until now, perhaps, and maybe that's why it hasn't come out until now. Yes, perhaps. Actually, Michael also says maybe he believes in the gremlins. Ooh.
I knew it.
Maybe. My show's that bad, right? My show is so bad that there's green gremlins and Blog Talk Radio who just want to cut it out.
You have a Debbie Jane fans.
Any more comments on the cane before we get to the thing here? Now, Deborah also put in the chat room a link with describing ties to David Axelrod, and that's from Ann Coulter's website. So Deborah has gone and done some work on these arbitrary claims. I mean, here's one more piece of advice about the arbitrary, the epistemology. Epistemology is just a fancy word for the branch of philosophy that gives you advice about acquiring knowledge. It tells you how you can acquire knowledge, how you should use your brain, your rational faculty to get it. And the terrible thing about the arbitrary is that if you let it cause you to doubt things, to think things are true, you're going to go out there causing yourself a whole lot of unnecessary stress and worry in some cases. You're going to be using all of your mental energy trying to disprove something that's completely arbitrary. The advice that a proper philosophy gives you about the arbitrary is you say, look, it's neither true nor false. Until somebody gives me some evidence in favor of it, I'm not really going to consider it. So this advice that Michael Hurd gives, which is just, you know, file them away. If we hear more in the way of real evidence, then that's fine. I'm perfectly fine. You know, I'm not going to close my mind to evidence. But until I see some, and I see some more than just an assertion from people of doubtful credibility, then I'm not going to make much of it. And, you know, like Ryan said here, we're going to be much more concerned about other aspects of Cain in deciding whether to vote for him. So on to our next topic. We are going to talk a little bit about Occupy Wall Street. This week has been rather bleak for the Occupy movement. Stories of disease and death have been spread around the internet.
Five deaths.
Some of the deaths, at least, are probably not at all related to Occupy themselves or the reasons that they do whatever they do, because it could have just been homeless people who sort of clung on to the movement, things like that. Now, you know, you could say the fact that homeless people were able to cling on to this and get, you know, do horrible things was made possible
some listeners might know more about that, about the details.
Yeah, they might know more. I mean, I was looking at some of the details this week. You know, I saw one story where they said there were two different deaths. I've also seen stories about some of the locations being shut down. Particularly, I read a story about Denver, and apparently they tried to say that the police, I think they had their kind of SWAT team gear and stuff, right? Riot gear and stuff on when they went in there, but they didn't have to do anything drastic. They were putting fires out, and in putting fires out, they were causing smoke to rise. And some people were saying, oh, they're using tear gas on the poor Occupy people. But
they all think the worst.
Yeah, what I heard is that there was no tear gas, that it was literally just putting these fires out. And they were told that they were supposed to evacuate by a certain time, and they hadn't. So they have been cleared out of Denver and I think some other locations as well. Maybe Oakland?
Yeah, that sounds right.
I think now in Oakland they had a death?
I think they did, yeah.
So
seems like that's the worst one.
Tuberculosis was something that I heard, that there was a case of tuberculosis found and that there were other cases of disease. Local businesses, it says, are holding a counter protest tomorrow.
Yeah,
that's interesting. The one thing I did read in the article about Denver was that the mayor promised that there would be no more protests allowed after 11 p.m. So this is a commitment that he's made to the local businesses and the residents there to try to clean that place up. And it's very good that he did it. To me, when I look at this, you've got these stories of disease, of death, some of which at least is caused by the nature of the Occupy movement itself, which, as far as I see Occupy, they're trying to cash in on the ethics of altruism, the ethics that says that the moral action is the one that you do while sacrificing for other people. They believe that they should be the object of sacrifice. They've been told that they deserve the things that they want simply because they demand them. And so they think they should be able to go off and get degrees from colleges, you know, degrees that are unmarketable on the job market that won't get them a job. And then they should just go out there and be able to be entitled to a job at a wage that they like, doing whatever it is that they want, and that all their student loans, they should either be able to pay them off with this job that is being dropped in their lap, or maybe the loan should be forgiven, and all sorts of other wonderful demands that they've made. Some of you know that I have a little side project called the Ayn Rand Bot. It's on Twitter. It's a Twitter account, and you can follow it if you like. It's at Ayn Rand Bot. So it's AynRandBot as the handle on Twitter. And what I do with that is I tweet out quotes from Ayn Rand, and recently I've been pulling quotes from the Letters book, Letters of Ayn Rand, and I found this one. Altruism is impossible to man, impossible by the whole nature of the universe. Altruism is death and destruction, end quote. Now, that is really strong language, but when I saw that, when you think, okay, altruism is death and destruction, insofar as some of the death and destruction that has happened in connection with the Occupy movement is because of them and the philosophy that they're acting on, I think this is quite apt. I mean, I'm a softie. I'm not the kind of person who likes to come in and slam these people with really hard language. I should do more of it, I think. But just to give you an example, if people are familiar with the movie Lost in America,
yeah.
Albert Brooks, right?
Oh, yeah.
Lost in
Great
America.
Movie.
So I watched that movie, and you're supposed to laugh at the people who have horrible things happen to them in Lost in America. And I can't. I'm too sympathetic. That's the kind of softie
I am. She falls into the movie.
I get
far deeper than that.
I get so I'm too empathetic.
Best,
that's all there is.
That's the kind of audience an artist wants, though.
I know. I know. But still, the point being is that when I look at this, when I see the disease and death, I don't go, ha ha, you know, Occupy, it proves that altruism is wrong. I mean, yeah, okay, it does. No, I'm not happy about it. So just there's your context. But speaking of that, here's the thing. The whole thing about, you know, altruism is that it demands someone be sacrificed.
Absolutely.
And so if someone's going to sacrifice and someone's going to be the recipient of the sacrifice, then they may as well be the recipient of the sacrifice, right? So here is somebody who is not reticent to speak his mind about the Occupy movement at all. Frank Miller, cartoonist Frank Miller, and he is very accomplished.
Oh, yeah.
List off.
Well,
Bosch knows all about him.
The Dark Knight Returns, Daredevil Born Again, Sin City, Batman Year One, you know, the original Daredevil series that he did. He's I mean, his work had more to do with my becoming a cartoonist than anyone else's. He's his most popular, most famous cartoon today, hands down.
So very, very prominent person in pop culture, most famous cartoonist out there. He publishes a blog post on his blog, and his blog is called
Frank Miller Inc.
FrankMillerInc.com?
.com.
Okay. And it's called Anarchy. He posted it on the 7th. And this is what he says. He says, everybody's been too damn polite about this nonsense. So I think I'm included probably in that. He says, the Occupy movement, whether displaying itself on Wall Street or in the streets of Oakland, which has, with unspeakable cowardice, embraced it, is anything but an exercise of our blessed First Amendment. Occupy is nothing but a pack of louts, thieves, and rapists, an unruly mob, fed by Woodstock-era nostalgia and putrid false righteousness. These clowns can do nothing but harm America. But wait, there's more from Frank Miller. Here he says, Occupy is nothing short of a clumsy, poorly expressed attempt at anarchy to the extent that the movement, some movement, except if the word bowel is attached, he says, is anything more than an ugly fashion statement by a bunch of iPhone, iPad-wielding spoiled brats who should stop getting in the way of working people and find jobs for themselves. And it goes on a little bit. I'm going to go ahead and skip down a little bit. He says, he's talking to the occupiers now. He says, maybe between bouts of self-pity and all the other tasty tidbits of narcissism you've been served up in your sheltered, comfy little worlds, you've heard terms like Al-Qaeda and Islamicism. Now, Islamicism is not my favorite term to use to refer to.
But, you know, he has said that he doesn't know squat about Islam. So that proves it.
Yeah, so Islamicism. Anyway, he says, look, there's a real enemy out there. He says, and this enemy of mine, not of yours apparently, must be getting a dark chuckle, if not an outright horse laugh, out of your vain, childish, self-destructive spectacle. And then he says, go home to your parents. Play Lords of Warcraft. Maybe you should actually enlist in the military because they'll whip you into shape. And then he says, they might not let you babies keep your iPhones, though. Try to soldier on, schmucks.
It's funny.
So he doesn't mince words at all. He's not like me, obviously. He doesn't have the slightest bit of sympathy for these people. And he's gotten quite the reaction, right?
Oh, wow.
So what about on his own blog?
On his own blog, I think literally thousands. Last I checked, 3,000 comments, and they've been occupying his blog, the occupiers. I hate you. You know, I will never buy another one of your books. I'm going to, you know, trade them. I'm going to sell them. I mean, he hit a nerve.
Now, why do you think he hit a nerve so much? I mean, why do they care what he thinks? Hasn't he sort of had a reputation for being right-wing-ish for a long time?
You know what? It's only lately is that reputation really hit him because, I mean, I think he always was, to an extent, right-wing, personally. Even in the 80s when he had Dark Knight, Batman was not a leftist. He was Dirty Harry in a Batman suit. I mean, that's what he was. He was right-wing. He was hardcore. But he was like, I think, David Mamet. David Mamet, I think, has always, he claimed that he was leftist or liberal years ago. I also am a strong artist, you know, using strong themes and expressing them in a strong way like Miller has. So I think they always had it in them, but now it's very explicit. And Miller has just clearly come out with no hesitation to where he stands, you know, pro-American, against the enemy, against these louts.
Now, they also had a post on Big Hollywood about this. And what has the reaction been there?
Great. I mean, people are loving it. You know, people are saying people bought Holy Terror because of his thing, yeah. They said deliberately they went and they bought it to support him. So it's great. The reaction is great. The counter reaction is funny. I mean, he's made them crazier than they are, the leftists. And clearly a figure like him to say what he said, that's what kills him. Because they want to pretend that they are not what they are. And when they're called what they are, you know, they go particularly crazy, especially by a guy with a big voice.
You said over 1,000 comments.
3,000.
Well, 3,000 on his page.
3,000, at least. At least. Comments to comments.
So I take it it's not moderated. There's all sorts of
I believe so.
Expletives.
Oh, yeah. Cursing him out. F you, Frank. I mean, they're just, this, you know, he clearly, I mean, truth hurts. And it hurts him
Now, do you think any of these people are actually true comic fans that are doing that? Or?
Some of them might be. Some of them just.
Or is it just occupiers going there because they were told by the leaders of their Occupy movement? By the way, I heard that the leader of Occupy. I read the whole article about the Denver evacuation or boot out, and they said that the current leader of the Occupy Denver movement, was a Collie mix dog, and
what?
I forget what the name was supposed to be, and that they tried to
a literal dog.
Who is their leadership?
Their leadership is Obama.
A tweet out there just telling them, go rant on this page.
I made a cartoon the other day, the Barockupire, the Barockupire in chief.
Yeah, look.
Yeah, 3,500. Wow.
Yeah, 3,500. Yeah, ask him if he cares. I mean, this is free publicity for him.
Absolutely.
I really like seeing this because it was not only was he brave enough to come out with Holy Terror and say something, a famous mainstream comic book artist saying something against this enemy.
Absolutely.
And, you've been working on this for years.
You
can't make a dent the way that he can make a dent in this issue. So that's excellent to see. And then for him to also go ahead and say, I'm going to say something about this other issue. Now, of course, he did bring the focus back to
the enemy.
Yeah. That we have a lot bigger fish to fry than the spoiled little demands that the Occupy people are making. They don't like X, Y, and Z. I think we've got both issues coming on simultaneously, but I think it's that the Occupy people are on the wrong side of the domestic
and also
issue.
The Occupy people, clearly they're not for the war, they're not for our defense. They're not in general.
No. And they're certainly not for making us financially stronger with the things that they're calling for. I mean, I don't think they, they have a college education, but do they look at what's happening to Greece? Do they see that if their demands are met, that we're just going to go down the road to Greece even further? So, I don't know. But you had said in terms of Holy Terror that you wanted to say a little bit about it.
I get a little mixed about it because I've been taking on Jihad for years in my own work, and I released my first issue, and to say I would do it differently, people can see that, and I think maybe Frank Miller might feel the same way about my work if you saw it. So I'm a little hesitant to even, talk about it too much, but I will say a few things about Holy Terror. First, the art in Holy Terror for the last few years. In recent years, I've seen a lack of concern on Miller on how the finished work looks in his comics. And as a fan of Alex Toth, Alex Toth always made it as clear, as consistent as he could, the art that he released, especially the finished work. And there are parts in Holy Terror where I couldn't tell exactly what was happening, where a body was, whose arm was where and what. And now, I still think Miller is hands down the best storyteller in comics in terms of telling the story in a dramatic visual form, page layouts, panels, etc. And some of the things he did in Holy Terror haven't been done before in comics, and they were effective as hell. There were a few in particular. And, there were a few scenes, a few really strong, unforgettable scenes and moments and words and terms that he uses. But again, I just, in terms of this enemy taking him on, I made it a point to study Islam and Jihad as much as I possibly could before I even wrote the book. And Miller has been coming out in interviews and saying that he doesn't know squat about Islam. And my question is, why not? 10 years you've had to find out this. I mean, what they would have done, his research, is give more insight into the book. But
I had one question about because isn't there in one of the pages some stoning?
Yeah. Exactly. So it's not outside of per se that he's going after.
Yeah,
he does go after Islam, in a very general way. But he says he doesn't know anything about it. And I don't know. I don't know why he says that. It's too late to protect yourself if you want to, you want to take them on or not. You can't go back and forth with it. And also just there was one moment in the story which I found a little, it just didn't make sense to me. It was there were a number of fighter jets, not passenger planes. They were fighter jets with missiles, and they were commandeered by some jihadists somehow, some way. And they flew them into a stand-in for the Statue of Liberty, the Lady Justice, I believe. Now, I think if jihadists are able to fly fighter jets, then they would use those missiles before using the jet as a missile itself. you know, this enemy wouldn't waste an opportunity to kill as many people as it could. And I just, small things like that, you know, just things that I look at, I said, well, this enemy is, their whole thing is to kill as many people as they possibly could, so why the hell would they fly these planes?
Isn't it possible that they would be too stupid to know how to fire the damn thing?
If they can fly that jet, then...
I remember how the hell would they get around the time of 9/11 that what they did is they learned how to fly
But only not how to land.
They didn't know how to take off or land, just how to fly during the... So it could be, right?
But overall, for Frank Miller, his position, his power to take on this enemy, that is, I mean, in the world we live in, that's as good as it can get right now, because he has pissed off the right people, the leftists, the Muslims on Twitter have been condemning him, and he's making all the right enemies right now, which is great, you know, good for him, and it's just great to see that someone of his position has taken on these things, and whatever, you know, problems I have with certain issues, concrete issues about the story itself. I mean, one thing about that, though, I can't judge it as a story per se, Holy Terror, because he has come out, clearly said this is propaganda. He wasn't concerned with writing a story as much, so I can't judge it based on that level. But again, kudos to him for taking him on.
Yeah, definitely. Any comments or questions here? Now, Batten says about all the comments on Frank Miller's blog, ask him if he cares. And that's good. I mean, he has said in the past, I remember you were saying that he said he hopes he makes people mad.
Right. He hopes to piss people off. Well, he has.
He's definitely sold a lot of books.
Absolutely.
For people who want to support.
It was Holy Terror was the best-selling graphic novel in September. As it ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
That's great to know.
Yeah. So let's hope that he's made the world safe for anti-jihad comics.
I think he has.
And we'll see how that
definitely
goes.
Definitely kick down that door.
Yeah. So are we ready from culture to politics? I don't have any more comments on here. Nobody wants to call in. Anybody want to call and criticize Miller for his anti-Occupy views? He's so mean. I mean, after all, look, this is really, really antisocial. He called them schmucks.
That's hilarious.
He called them schmucks.
That's what you call people that term respect. You know,
I
wrote a comment. I said they're occupying your website. You know,
well,
and they were,
and that's what they're doing. And in fact, you know, I hate traffic of all kinds, and one of the types
block traffic.
No, I don't hate block traffic.
I love block traffic.
Come visit my blog at don'tletitgo.com. I hate traffic, the kind that you have as obstacles when you're driving in the world. So one of the types of traffic that I hate is when I'm driving in the school zone and you have all the students, especially high school students, who are walking in the crosswalks as slowly as they can while they're texting, and they're like the only thing between you and getting where you need to go. This is terrible. So I used to call them molasses. That's what I would say. I'd say, oh, God, there's some molasses again. And then I'd be waiting there for minutes and minutes while these, you know, if I drive by the high school at the wrong time of the day. You know, they reluctantly drag. It's like, oh, they resent being alive, you know, and they're walking across the street. And now I'm starting to call them occupiers. So the Occupy movement has given me new language to use when I complain about pedestrian traffic.
Occuparasites.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I guess now Randy says something about it's the only language that they understand, it seems, and I'm not sure if he...
Maybe Miller's.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It could be. So
it was great to see. And he's getting a lot of press for this, you know, which is great.
Definitely good. Okay. So let's go on to our political segment. Bosch is going to snore and fall asleep on us. I have been calling this segment Hope is Just a Little Bit Better Than Despair. And if you go and search Hope is Just a Little Bit Better Than Despair on my blog, you can see why and what that means. And this week in particular, we had two debates, not just one, but I couldn't even believe it. And on the Saturday night, what are they doing to us, right? So one of the debates was on the economy. The other was on foreign policy. Wednesday was focused on the economy. And most of the reaction that I had that I published out there was to Romney and what he said. And, you know, what I want to do in any venue that I can is communicate in the strongest way possible that Mitt Romney does not stand for free markets. He does not stand for capitalism or individual rights. So watch the debate. He did a bunch of his usual junk, and I sat there afterwards thinking, okay, Romney, R-O-M-N-E-Y, I've got to come up with that being an acronym for something that really stands for what the guy is. That's hard, R-O-M-N-E-Y. So you got to come up with something that, you know, actually makes a sentence. So on my blog, Don't Let It Go, this is what I posted on Wednesday, November 9th, after the debate. Republican ominously morphs into neo-egalitarian yes man. That's Romney. Republican ominously morphs into neo-egalitarian yes man. I tried a lot of alternatives before that. I didn't spend too much time, but I think I'm embarrassed that I spent some time doing that. So I'm sorry if that's a bit corny, but after hearing a bunch of his big government nonsense on Wednesday, I couldn't resist. So here's some choice tidbits from the debate. He said, and this is going to be a quote from him, Romney said, when asked why he supported a progressive income tax, because if you remember, everybody else has got their flat tax, right? You've got the 999 from Herman Cain. You've got a 20% flat tax from Rick Perry.
Right.
But Romney has said that he continues to support a progressive income tax, progressive meaning higher percentage paid by people who make more. This is what he says, quote, I want to take our precious dollars as a nation, dot, dot, dot. And then he goes on to talk about what he wants to do. Mm-hmm. Essentially, what he said he wanted to do was to help those people who have been hurt the most. He says, oh, the rich, they're doing fine. It's the middle class that I want to help. So my question for Mitt Romney is, whose dollars?
What?
He talks like a big government politician. He says he wants to take our precious
right.
dollars as a nation. They are not his dollars.
No, they're not.
They are the dollars of the people who earn them. So be very careful to listen how this, you know, the way this guy speaks, because it tells you his mindset.
Absolutely.
And what kind of president he's going to be. So that's,
and then no one would think twice when he says that as well, which is pretty scary.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just one. So then he says, also he says, we should get healthcare to work more like a market. More like a market. He doesn't want it to work as a market, right? You don't want a free
right.
market. It should work more like a market. We got to have some government,
right.
you know? So he's implying that there's going to be government, you know, having a role in healthcare. He said also on healthcare, he says, quote, government is playing too heavy a role
mm-hmm.
in healthcare.
Right, exactly right.
End quote. So the translation there is that government, which of course is force, what is government? Government is the entity that has a monopoly on the retaliatory use of physical force. It uses force to stop people from violating other people's rights or to retaliate when people violate each other's rights. That's what government is. It's force. So he's saying that government, i.e. force, has a role to play in healthcare. And my answer is it has no such role, of course. Government is force. A gun is not a doctor. A gun cannot diagnose, treat, or cure any disease, right? Then another one. Romney proudly announces that he plans to cap spending. Sounds good, right? But he's going to cap it at 20%. Now, he didn't say 20% of what
right
then during
right.
the debate. Of course, what he means is 20% of GDP, GDP being gross domestic product. Romney thinks that he's saying something bold when he says that he wants the government to spend 1/5 of our gross domestic product on government.
And how he knows bold? Because he says it bold.
Well, he says it's bold. He says it's a stark departure from Obama. So, and then there's another one. Romney says, I love free trade, but. And then he goes on to talk about his plans to crack down on cheaters like China in the form of course, higher tariffs. This is going to make goods from China more expensive at a time when he and others on the stage were saying they didn't want to increase taxes. But, of course, if they put a tariff on goods coming from China, that's just another way of increasing taxes on us. So he's completely inconsistent. So those are just the five things that I happened to catch in the debate and include there in my blog post. He uses the phrase free enterprise in his plan, that little five-page executive summary of his 59-point plan. 59-point plan. Free enterprise. But he doesn't stand for it. And I'm just going to keep throwing evidence at people to show you how this man thinks and that he is
He's
for
terrible.
Anything except free enterprise. Here's some other choice tidbits from the debate on Wednesday. Perry spoke as if it was possible that a government regulation could create jobs.
Right.
Okay. Regulations are force, right? So how does force create a job? It doesn't. If you remove force from people, if you remove the regulations, but he actually spoke, and it shows maybe he was just disconnected. He wasn't thinking at the time, because probably if I sit here and talk with him, he realizes that government doesn't create jobs. I think I've heard him say as much before, but you know, I'll pass these regulations that will create jobs is the sort of thing he said. So he's just not thinking. Perry brags that he will balance the budget. Wait for the punchline. He'll balance it in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Great. I mean, these politicians who keep kicking the can down the road, you know, 10 years out from now, we'll have this huge cut in spending, right? Perry's answer to the student loan crisis is to have state governors put pressure on the universities to lower their tuition. Mm-hmm. Now, tuitions are high because of government-subsidized student loans. So why not just pull that out, pull that rug out from under these universities? But instead, he wants to have more government involvement just to have price controls. So, you know, have the government subsidize. It's just like healthcare.
Politics are insignificant. That's why they want to have this kind of power. Yeah. And that's why they go into politics.
Yeah. And then, of course, everyone watched as the Republican debate morphed into sitcom-worthy cringe TV when Rick Perry can't remember the third agency that he wants to cut. And I love it. He looks to Ron Paul for help, and Ron Paul says, no, there's five. There's five that you've got to cut. He hasn't given any of them.
But he keeps it himself.
It's so funny. I mean, it's not that Rick Perry wants to cut five, but Ron Paul saying, no, you should be cutting five like I want to cut. I would just love if we could have Ron Paul's cut, you know, spending cutting plan, you know, his plan to cut spending and just nothing else. Could you just have somebody like a Herman Cain, we could implant some foreign policy knowledge into him and then have him adopt the spending cut portion of
Frankenstein candidate.
We do. We need Frankenstein. I don't know. How about this discussion that they had about banks getting bigger, this too big to fail stuff? The phrase kept coming out. If they're too big to fail, then they're too big. Then the question is, how do you make it so they're not so big?
What?
Now, the free market answer to how you make it that a bank is not so big is that you remove the regulations off the banking industry so that small banks can afford to survive. It's only the big banks that can absorb the cost of compliance with the regulation state, right? So that's how you make them smaller. But instead, you've got Huntsman out there.
Putzman,
he calls him now.
Terrible.
Right-sizing was the phrase he used, right-sizing. So he wants to have more regulations to tell the banks what size they can be. So they put all these regulations on them so that they can't afford to exist unless they're huge, because then they can absorb these increased costs because they have the economies of scale of a large bank. And, oh, my God, I love this. I just got a comment in the chat room that is interrupting my train of thought, but it's excellent. We'll talk about it in a second. Yeah, so you know, they've got this regulatory state that is making it so only the big banks can survive.
Right.
And then they say, oh, well, we're going to cut you down in size. Before we go to our caller, we've got a caller here. We've got Ryan on the chat room saying that the New York Times was criticizing Romney's radical brand of capitalism today.
Mm.
Imagine a future in which he's the face of capitalism. Exactly. And this is what we're going to talk about when we talk about voting strategies, Ryan. So hang on for that. Let me go ahead and get this caller here. Hello, you're on the air if you can hear me.
Hi, Amy.
Oh, hey, Deborah. How are you?
Good. Good to talk to you. So, you know, I think my favorite part of that debate was probably when I think they even led with this question. The reporter asked Herman Cain about his allegedly being guilty of sexual harassment, and the audience started booing. And then when the guy turned around me and asked him, you know, would you hire him permit came for your for a CEO in one of your companies in light of, you know, the questionable character. And I thought they were going to start throwing rotten vegetables at these media people. The audience was just like, it was so nice to hear
them.
They
have set the term with the media. They said, we're not going to discuss this. We're going to talk about, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was fairly early in the debate when they had that. And the woman, I forget the woman's name, but I know that some people are saying, oh, she's so cute, she's wonderful. But she had just said that they were going to focus on economic issues. And two minutes later, she's talking about this. Yeah, it was bad. They definitely lost points for that, for bringing that scandal into the debate that they had just said minutes before would
focus
on the economy. No class at all. But I did love it. I love the audience reaction to it and their reaction to Kane's answer.
I hated the audience's reaction to Ron Paul, though. A little too complimentary.
Oh, they were too positive. Well, that's because he was talking to economics.
Right. Yeah, but he also said about the war, like, we got to get out and this and that.
Well, there's some truth in some of that he says,
sure,
too. So we'll talk about that. So that was your favorite part of the whole thing?
Yeah, I liked that a lot. And just it was just really reassuring to hear the people's virulent rejection of this sleazy media, because they're not interested. I mean, like you were talking about trying to get information, and in this case, all we can really, based on the evidence that we have available to us now, all we can do is look into the character of the accusers and of Herman Cain and just sort of, you know, get some idea for how likely it is that they're telling the truth. We can't really know anything, but the media is acting like he's been, like, it's just a given, and it's just settled fact that Herman Cain did do all this stuff, and they're going out of their way to smear him, and it's just so dirty and so obvious. And it was just nice to see them some justice, you know, when they got booed for going after him like that.
You know, the only question is, are they victims themselves, the media, these members of the media, are they victims of progressive education such that they really don't understand that even if you add up 5, 10, whatever you have, arbitrary allegations, that they still add up to nothing, that they don't mean anything unless you get some solid evidence?
That coupled with them being leftists. Absolutely.
Well, right. Or they might know better. They probably do. Hopefully they've had a logic class somewhere. And they are counting on the fact that the audience is duped by this. You know, and then I've seen people who I think are better, whom I respect, you know, in a lot of ways for their commentary. So, you know, Tammy Bruce, she has a lot of good political commentary and knowledge. But she, I think, has given a little too much credence to the accusers in this particular case.
Being a woman,
and in particular said, you know, because there's 5 of them, then suddenly, you know, that means something. You know, again, 5 times 0 = 0. Until I see some actual evidence, like if you show me, for instance, that Herman Cain upgraded that woman's hotel room, right? You know, that was one thing that they talked about. If you showed me that, then I would start going, okay, there's a piece of concrete evidence where I would start to worry. But I haven't seen, have you seen anything, Deborah, in all of the articles that you've looked at, anything solid that you could hang your hat on with respect to this case?
No. I haven't seen anything factual. I've only seen kind of basically what you've already discussed and the stuff in those links that I posted. I haven't seen any facts, nothing like that, no.
Yeah, and I mean, until we do, you know, what are we going to do? So did you have any other favorites from that debate before I continue on? Because I've got a few more things to point out to people.
No, that's good.
Okay. Well, feel free to join in again if you've got more, because we've got a lot to talk about with these candidates here. Thanks for calling in.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so then we've got Ron Paul. He was very good on the healthcare issues in that economic debate. Free market, get government out.
Sure.
But too bad he's not nearly as good on foreign policy, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. Now, Bosch said, this was something that he had tweeted out, and a number of them have said this, in that economic debate. He says, when politicians say that they're not prepared to raise taxes in a slow economy, are they prepared to pull a fast one in a fast economy? You know, there's a number of them that say, well, we can't afford that
now.
They take
it out to give them,
So we're perfectly fine to have the altruist state imposed on everybody, but we're just not going to do it at, you know, the time when the economy's hurting. We'll do it later. They just want to put it off.
Yep.
So there's that. As we said, CNBC loses points for bringing the irrelevant issue of the Cain scandal, especially given that they had just laid the ground rules that they would focus on the economy. Saturday's debate focused on foreign policy. Now, I see the chat room. They're getting into their whole discussion. they're not even talking to us. They're talking to each other. It's getting pretty involved in there. So that's good and fine. Now, Saturday's debate focused on foreign policy. First, they kept picking on Cain.
Yeah.
They have some, you know, interesting or difficult question. They have decent questions. Some people said their questions were bad. I didn't think their questions were terrible.
No, you
might not like the way that they actually moderated, you know, amongst the candidates, but the questions were decent. You know, there were things that you could learn.
That Centel was brought in.
That was the economic debate. Now we're talking about Saturday's forum. See, there's so many debates you can't
They were closed by days, weren't they? Three, four
days? Yeah, just a few days in between debates. These guys are working like crazy. They need more time to study, right, in between their debates. But so they kept picking on Cain, and I think that was bad and good. You know, it was bad in the sense that he was the first who had to answer, and the other guys got to sit there and think and prepare what they were going to say. It was good in the sense that he didn't have to follow anybody who might have been a hard act to follow, and you know, in the eyes of some people, Romney could be a hard act to follow. In the eyes of a lot of us, I think Gingrich was a hard act to follow on, you know, this particular debate in the foreign policy. He said some very good things. So, you know, he did okay. He had no major gaffes, but he didn't impress me either. Here's an example. He could have given a much better answer on the question of what we need to know to determine if Pakistan is a friend or foe. He was very vague. He wasn't concrete at all in terms of why we would question whether Pakistan was a friend or think they were a foe.
And he made the case against them being a foe when he said that they, you know, that they held Bin Laden there for a number of years. Was it him or someone else who brought that up? But regardless.
Yeah, he was too vague. Everybody else had a lot more concrete knowledge.
Not to be aware. And why wouldn't he be aware? He's running for president.
Yeah, and maybe he is aware, but it's like the things that he's rehearsed and that he's prepared to speak about in debates are things having to do with overall methodology and strategy to attack particular problems versus delving into the details.
He has a tendency to say things that he regrets saying, so maybe he's overthinking it. Maybe he's really being cautious now.
It could be. So he's always sticking to the prepared script that has to do with an overall approach.
Yeah.
Anyway, another question they asked him, how will you know if you're getting the right advice from your generals? His answer was, well, I'm going to have multiple people who are providing all the facts and giving me different alternatives in terms of recommendations. So that's good, again, methodologically, but we also need to be confident that he has enough concrete knowledge about these situations going on around the world so that he can hit the ground running in January of 2013 if he's elected. This is what Michelle Bachmann hinted at during one of her answers, that we do need a president who is ready to hit the ground running. He's got the knowledge in his mind. So that was one. She didn't directly attack him, but I think that's what she meant when she said that. She meant Cain. Cain did say that waterboarding is not torture, in his opinion. He did say he was against torture. So some of us may or may not agree with that. A lot of people do agree
torturing
that.
Whom?
If you're torturing terrorists, it's maybe a different story for some people. For Cain, he says he's against torture, but waterboarding and other enhanced interrogation techniques are fine.
Our soldiers get waterboarded. They do as part of their training. So what? Our government's torturing them anyway.
Bachmann agrees also. Waterboarding is okay. And she says she had a good line. She says, don't let the ACLU run the CIA. Throw those acronyms out there. Now, Romney, earning many kudos from me again, right? He blames the situation on Obama.
Right.
He just blames the Iran situation, the fact that Iran is close to getting nukes, maybe has nukes. He's blaming the situation on Obama, and that's what he said explicitly in the debate. He blames it on Obama. But there has been bipartisan appeasement of Iran for over 30
years.
I posted 30 years, and then someone said 32 years and however many months, right?
Absolutely.
But, you know, Bosch.
This particular thing is not Obama's fault.
One of Bosch's best cartoons ever, I think, was the one called Iran.
It was I, space, Ran.
Yeah, I, space, Ran. And it's six presidents.
All saying.
all
saying Iran,
running away from Iran, basically.
Within
not,
the nuclear symbols. If it
yeah, not properly dealing with the Iran situation. Now, Romney here blaming only Obama for Iran getting nukes is part of a larger pattern that he has.
Right.
Again, if you go back to that five-page summary of the 59-point plan on his website, I think it's probably still there, although this last week he seemed to make some statement about maybe they've posted new stuff on his site, so who knows if he's modifying.
So it's 100 and something now.
I think it's still 59 points, you know, but this five-page summary was up there. And he, again, repeatedly in that five-page summary says, oh, well, I'm going to look at the Obama-era regulations and see which ones are costing us money. I'm going to repeal things that Obama did. Obama, Obama, Obama.
He's relying on the anti-Obama sentiment.
Exactly. It's like, oh, the Tea Party is about nothing except reacting to Obama.
Right. Exactly right.
And you know, I think any better Tea Partier knows that George W. Bush
set us up
for this. He was almost as bad. He did a lot of...
He spent like crazy. He stunk in the war.
And it's only the big government GOP establishment that is, you know, sanctioning someone like a Bush or like a Romney that's going to make it that way. So I would say that, you know, if Romney was elected, he would be another George W. Bush for sure, or worse, because the only thing he keeps talking about is Obama this, Obama that, Obama's the worst. It's no, there has been a lot of presidents before Obama that have gotten us into this mess, doing the same sorts of things, just to a lesser degree, and Romney would do it, I think, only to a slightly lesser degree.
Someone said that Romney has to be pushed in order to be conservative. If he's not pushed, he'll just revert back to liberalism.
Right. Now, Romney did say, he says, if you elect me as the next president, Iran will not have nuclear weapons.
Bush said
end
the same
quote.
Thing. He says they will not get him. I mean, he left with them, you know,
yeah.
on their way to get him.
He talks, of course, about using diplomatic or economic pressure first, working with the insurgents, so to speak. We don't even know what the state of the insurgent movement is there anyway, but, you know, he says he wants to do that. He implied that, yes, taking some sort of military action as a last resort was something he had very much on the table. So he signaled willingness to use military action to stop Iran from getting nukes. So that's at least good. Gingrich says use every possible pressure short of war. If that doesn't work, then military action is proper, like Romney. Of course, Gingrich is more explicit about it, though. Gingrich also, it was funny, they asked him, I think they asked this question to him third about what do you do about Iran with the nukes. And he said, look, all the answers on the table so far were better than what Obama has been doing. But at that point when he gave that answer, you know, and that's the answer he's been giving in so many debates, he says, look, all of us are better than Obama. If any of us gets elected, you know, he's the conciliatory great statesman. You know, he's playing
politician.
Oh yeah, it's like he's just sitting in the background, giving his little bits of wisdom out there. He's very calm.
He's the leader of this group almost. That's how he's trying to act.
Yeah,
I'll tolerate them until
being so conciliatory, he's kind of waiting for the rest of them to self-destruct, and then he'll be ready, to jump
in.
And he's doing well. He's doing better in the polls, so this is obviously working for him. But
and he says things enough. It's like him and Romney, their whole thing is, they're looking to fool us because something they say is pretty damn good, especially Gingrich. Something says it's pretty damn good.
Oh, yeah, he said some really excellent things in the debate last night.
But they look at it and say, well, he's just trying, who can fool us better, him or Romney?
Yeah.
That's a debate right now.
Yeah, we'll get to a little bit more on Gingrich as well. So when Gingrich did give this, you know, look, all the answers on the table so far are better than Obama's, they hadn't yet spoken to Ron Paul. And Ron Paul, of course, said, and you've seen this in the news, that we should do nothing at this time. The thing we're supposed to do is try to become friends with
offer
Iran.
Offer them friendship. Right? Offer
them
Iran,
friendship.
Our enemy.
Now,
friendship.
He did not say in the debate
of course.
He toned down.
Someone told him.
Someone told him. He says, you're coming across as a lunatic. You're going to have to tone
you
down your normal stuff.
Maybe some called him.
During the interviews, he did say offer them friendship, but somehow he didn't say something like that during the debate. Santorum was clear about what victory in Afghanistan means. He said the victory in Afghanistan means Taliban is no longer a security threat, period. I think that's very good. So if you talk about the fact that the proper objective in war is to remove the threat at it with as little cost to us as possible, and you define that as victory, I think that's good. On Iran, he said, we should give money to the opposition, and we should also impose sanctions, but that's also not enough. We need strikes. And he was really the only one who was avidly calling and stating explicitly that we should work with the Israelis to take out the nuclear weapon sites in Iran. He explicitly spoke about strikes on the areas there. But then there was also a later question to him. His key agenda is Iran must not get nukes. So he was very strong on that. Huntsman said, we've achieved our objectives in Afghanistan because they've had elections.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So we should get out because all we're doing now is nation building. He didn't talk about what was just fed to him by his colleague on stage, Santorum. He should have been listening to Santorum. You know, instead, he's formulating his, you know, preamble in his mind. But, you know, the question to Huntsman is, look, is the Taliban still a security risk to us? If not, we haven't achieved our objectives. I don't care whether they've had elections. I just care if they leave us alone and if they're a security risk to us. Gingrich was funny. He says, Afghanistan is the least important of the three countries that are in the region. Afghanistan is geographically apparently situated right between Iran and Pakistan. He says, they're the least important one. The other two are the big fish. Perry took a very strong stand on foreign policy in terms of the foreign aid budget. Repeatedly, he said that the foreign aid budget for every country out there should start at zero, and then they have to prove that they're worth giving money to, not this idea that we just keep doling it out every year as we have.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, he was asked later in the debate, are you sure that's what you meant? And he said, yes, every country should start at zero. And then he said, the same should be applied to the government departments. All the departments in the government, they should start at zero and then prove why they need the money. As it stands now, they spend all the money that they were given last year to prove that they need it again, and that's how they prove it, by spending it all. Gingrich says also he would start with foreign aid budget at zero and put the burden on them to prove why they should have any, and said Pakistan is not an ally who deserves our money. And then Michelle Bachmann, though, she says, you know, and she was good on a number of issues. Like I said, she said the ACLU shouldn't be running the CIA. But she said she would not pull foreign aid from Pakistan. And she wouldn't do it because they have nukes.
Nuclear blackmail.
So this is the idea. And unfortunately, John Bolton said the same thing
in an article earlier
this year. Yes. Terrible. That we need to be friends with Pakistan because they have nukes.
How about denuking them?
That would be good. Giving them money is going to prevent Al-Qaeda from getting the nuclear weapons. I don't know. Gingrich said some very good things. He said the Arab Spring is turning into the anti-Christian Spring.
Right.
And he said he was concerned about hostilities against non-Muslim religions.
Hmm.
So he made a point of saying non-Muslim religions.
Yeah.
Like, well, how about non-Muslims, right? What about us atheists?
They're against all non-Muslims.
Atheists were just left out there to hang and dry. I don't know what he thinks. So, you know, I was wondering if maybe he thinks if he just keeps refusing to mention atheists as part of the class of non-Muslims that we'll just cease to exist.
No, he doesn't believe we exist, like we don't believe God exists. That's what he thinks.
Yeah. I guess we're just going to go away or something. I have no idea. Santorum. Now we'll talk about the power of religion. Are you ready? Santorum. I couldn't even believe he was saying this. He says, the Pakistanis must be our friends. We must engage them. Because they have nuclear weapons. That's what he said. He said they must be our friends. We must engage them, he said. So immediately in my mind, because it was this primacy of consciousness way of thinking and the description of it was fresh in my mind, I had an article I wrote about Steve Jobs and his sometimes having primacy of consciousness as a way of thinking. You think he is definitely, Santorum is definitely putting an I wish before an it is in this particular situation. It's like, well, they must be our friends.
And then,
they have to be because they have nuclear weapons.
If Iran gets nukes, he's friends with them.
Right. And that's the natural thing, too. It's like, look, Santorum is just coming onto the Ron Paul bandwagon.
And he said that,
now that Iran is close to getting nukes, what does Ron Paul say we're supposed to do? We're supposed to become their friend. And so Santorum is saying, well, the Pakistani, they have to be our friends. We have to engage them because they have nukes. So really what they're saying is that the way to become the friend of the United States, which means the way to have money thrown at you, is to get nuclear weapons.
Absolutely right.
So if you can get Russia or some other country to develop your nuclear weapons program, then
which,
you can start getting free money from the United States.
And when Santorum says that he hopes Iran doesn't get nukes, I take that as he doesn't want to friend them, like he friends Pakistan. So he's, you know, I want to be their friends because if they get nukes, I have to be their friends. And that
I,
is,
I guess that's it. Yeah. So
that's stupid. No, but I think she was trying to be a contrarian.
Yeah. Now you had your tweet out there. You call him Sanborum now.
Yeah, Sanborum. I said Sanborum just said that we must be quote unquote friends with Pakistan because they have nukes. So when Iran gets nukes, he'd be friends with them too.
Yeah, sure.
And then you.
Yeah. This path of friendship. You just get nukes and suddenly you're our friend. It's awesome.
Hey buddy.
Now, the other argument that he gave, right, for why we have to continue to give foreign aid to Pakistan is because it creates jobs.
Unbelievable.
Now, why does it create jobs? Because when we give foreign aid to these countries, including to Israel, we put all these strings on it. We attach all these strings, and the strings are that they have to use the money that we give them to purchase weapons from companies here in the United States. A certain percentage, at least, has to be used to purchase those weapons. So isn't that wonderful? It creates jobs, right? It's wonderful. Maya here says Santorum is wasting precious oxygen in the debate. Yeah, a number of people have said, okay, look, it's time for Santorum, Bachman, and Huntsman, basically, at least.
Just get out.
To get out. At least,
Ron Paul is a little entertaining in a
well,
sick way.
Well, and he injects some good ideas here or there, at least, yeah, like you said, some entertainment. And he's smart. Ron Paul's smart, but and plus he's getting some serious poll numbers still,
yeah,
unlike
he's
the other one.
He's insane on foreign policy. He's an idiot, and that's what we'll bury him.
Yeah. So here's Santorum, right? Santorum says we're creating jobs by giving foreign aid.
That's incredible.
Okay. Now, couldn't you think that you could create jobs better by letting people keep more of the money that they earn instead of wasting it, not through only layers of domestic bureaucracy, right? There's all the layers of domestic bureaucracy when our money is taxed, right? Mm-hmm. So anything that they spend domestically, a lot of your tax dollars don't even go to the program. They're wasted through all these layers of bureaucracy and government inefficiency. But now it goes through ours and through the foreign government. And a lot of times it just ends up in the hands of the terrorists, and we're helping our enemies destroy us. So that is a ridiculous reason to continue foreign aid, this idea that it creates jobs. Ron Paul, because it is a foreign policy debate, he did, even though I think he toned his message down a little bit, come out with some fantastic, meaning crazy, positions as usual. The definition of fantastic means, you know, out of this world, nutty, bizarre. Torture is illegal, he says. Waterboarding is torture. It's illegal, immoral, and impracticable. It's uncivilized. It's un-American. So you can be the worst terrorist in the world. You can have a ticking time bomb. Nothing. He thinks it's wrong, un-American to torture.
I tweeted after that. I said, waterboarding is not torture. Ron Pauling is. Anyway, go on.
Ron Paul says, we're overthrowing dictatorships that we've supported. We should not get involved in Syria and elsewhere. I would say that the first part of that is true at least, and maybe we shouldn't get involved in Syria. Again, the test of whether we should get involved is whether the particular country poses a threat to us, some sort of imminent threat,
right.
And if so, we should get involved. I would say Iran's a lot more dangerous.
But according to Ron Paul, we have no enemies. I mean, we don't.
Yeah, yeah. And we have to wait for them to strike first, according
to
him.
And we clear them all.
Yeah, we did create our enemies. You know, we were responsible for 9/11.
Right.
Now, Bachman did call Ron Paul on his opposition to the killing of Osama bin Laden.
Right.
And then Paul very cleverly did this, I voted he said he voted, the vote was 10 years ago. To,
when he was a little more sane.
Yeah, to kill Osama bin Laden. So he tried to say, oh, no, I was really for killing Osama bin Laden.
He went on the record recently that he was
killed. Yeah, but around the time that Osama bin Laden was actually killed, he said he was against us having done it. He said or implied that we violated the rule of law and that we violated Pakistani sovereignty. That was what he said earlier this year when Osama bin Laden was killed.
Can I just say about the rule of law and Gingrich and what he said about...
Yeah, I'm definitely going to get to that.
That's good.
So, you know, in reaction to Ron Paul, I met a new friend on Twitter. His name is John Ciccioni. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly. He says, I do believe Ron Paul speaks from the heart. Unfortunately, that heart beats somewhere in the basement of Bellevue Psychiatric Hospital.
Perfect.
Which I loved. Huntsman agreed with Ron Paul. He says, this country has values. He says, I've got a ton of experience. Mm-hmm. And he says, we diminish our standing in the world when we torture, including waterboarding, which he counts as torture. Romney took a stand against the Ron Paul type and said that he agrees with Obama.
Stand, right?
Yeah, this is a bold stand. He agrees with Obama. That's how bold it is. who ordered the killing of al-Awlaki. He says al-Awlaki was aligning himself with al-Qaeda, so at least, you know, Romney was good on that. He says he wants America to lead the free world and for the free world to lead the rest of the world, and he'll strengthen America. So
Romney has also said that jihad has nothing to do with Islam, but go on.
Yeah, exactly. Gingrich was excellent on the al-Awlaki killing. He said al-Awlaki was found guilty by a panel, the appropriate sort of panel.
And he was challenged by the moderator.
Yeah, he was challenged by the moderator on this. He says, no, you know, there was a panel, an appropriate type of government panel in this type of proceeding that determined that al-Awlaki was seeking the death of Americans.
Yep.
And he says, this is rule of law in
Absolutely.
This context. She was saying, well, doesn't it violate the rule of law?
Outside
says,
of our rule of law.
This is rule of law in this context. And he says, al-Awlaki was an enemy combatant, and so therefore he forfeits his civil rights.
That was good.
He says, Gingrich, this is, you know, so novel coming from, I mean, it's not, Gingrich, I guess, is good on some things, but he says, the correct thing to do in a war is to kill people who are trying to kill you. Duh. Right?
Paul would have.
But to say something that bold, it just doesn't happen. He says, the correct thing to do in a war is to kill people who are trying to kill you, which is excellent. And he didn't say, kill people who have shot a weapon at you. Kill people who are trying to kill you.
Yeah.
And I think he would put Iran in that category. Romney was terrible on China again because
he
got to talk about his pet issue of China's manipulation of the currency.
Bold stand.
Now, I'm not a financial markets expert, but isn't China just making all their stuff cheaper for us to buy? And isn't it true that tariffs would just hurt us?
Absolutely right.
I mean, that's my impression. So I he needs to get off of this. And this is my impression of Romney. And this is the pattern that I've seen with him debate after debate. They ask him a question. He is so impressively smart, right? He just has his brain filled with some standard speech on that topic.
Well, he's not.
And
yeah.
He can talk all the way.
Really fast.
He speaks really quickly.
No one can question or should question what he's saying.
Yeah, he speaks really quickly. He dumps all sorts of knowledge into his answer to show you how impressively well-versed he is in the facts.
Don't interrupt me.
Yeah, don't interrupt him. And as soon as the minute is up, he's ready to stop speaking. It's not like he for sure has to get something out most of the time. You know,
nothing was really said.
You know, some things are said, but, you know, he's got his speech. Now, my impression with respect to this China issue is that he thinks he can speak really fast and sound really impressive, and he can get us to conflate, to put together in our minds two different issues, two very separate issues. He's trying to have us put them together in our minds so he can get his agenda across. One is the Chinese committing actual crimes, because he talks about IP theft and hacking into our computer systems, actual crimes, right? But then he tries to put together with that, to conflate with that, China making stuff cheap, making the prices artificially low. Who cares? They suffer, right? If they make their prices artificially low, they suffer. They can't afford to do it forever. Their economy is going to collapse, right? And they're making things cheaper for us. Why would we want to slap tariffs on it and then have resources that don't need to be spent by our people, right? I mean, you're going to Walmart. You have a budget that you're trying to keep for your family. And Romney says, oh, well, I think I'm going to go ahead and put some tariffs on so these things aren't so cheap because,
right.
You know, it's killing competition.
Right.
We need to make America competitive by killing all these regulations, getting rid of all the job-killing regulations.
He's concerned about our domestic policies.
Yeah.
Not get the hell out of the way.
This idea of, you know, and it's not even a Band-Aid.
You know what? It's,
you know, you could say it's a Band-Aid, but it's like,
about something.
It's adding insult to injury. Because
and there's an audience for that.
I guess there is. You know,
no,
the,
people are like,
oh,
yeah.
You know, keep jobs here. But
tariffs.
How do you create jobs here? You create jobs here by freeing up resources that people can use to invest. And if you think by adding another tariff, another tax onto something, that you're going to create jobs, Then they had this little brief interlude on spending. Romney talked about his 20%. And then Huntsman comes in. He's got this huge preamble talking about the spending problem. And then he says he'd adopt the Ryan plan. And then he says he would spend only 19% of GDP.
That's all
18%. Yeah. I was like, come on, do I hear 15%? You know, whatever. They've got to get it way down. The only one who's talked about serious cuts is, unfortunately, Ron Paul. Bachman gave a very disturbing statistic, and no one challenged her on it. She said, in the month of October of this year, just in October, because of the way that Obama's been spending, every man, woman, and child in the United States per capita took on how much in debt, do you think? $650. So her answer is that she wants to target the programs that LBJ put in under the Great Society in the 60s. And, you know, she only got a few seconds to talk, so that's all she could say. But I thought that was a very disturbing statistic. So overall, in foreign policy, in that foreign policy debate, Gingrich seemed to be the best. He hit a home run in my book with that Alawaki answer. And all I could say about Kane is that I was glad that he was on the right side of a lot of the issues.
Right. He didn't blow it.
He didn't blow it. But Gingrich
he didn't add anything.
Yeah, right. Gingrich had knowledge and was strong
on
the
issues. So reluctant to say so. And that brings up here also, he was on that couch with Pelosi 2008 doing a global warming ad for Al Gore. That stuff lived down. Supposedly he said that's one of the worst things he's ever done politically, but whatever. Why the hell did he do that?
Yeah, so there's that. And then there's the thing for which, you know, again, I look at what they say and how they say it as evidence of how they think, right?
And how they would act with power.
And with Gingrich, there was a Tea Party event a couple of years ago. Gingrich was on TV with Sean Hannity. Hannity gives him the softball question. He says, you know, Speaker Gingrich, isn't the conflict today between capitalism and socialism? And then Gingrich said no. He says the conflict is between American families and power-hungry politicians.
Lousy.
Stupid.
Yeah.
Unprincipled. Untrue. I mean, yeah, there's some corruption in politics. We see it all the time. But the reason that they can be corrupted is because they have so much darn power. They have, you know, the government doing too many of the wrong things, which gives them the ability to get corrupted in the first place.
I think, again, they try to be contrarian. They try to like, state terms in the wrong way. Like, Hannity brought it up that way. Well, let me say something different.
Yeah.
Let me try to be the smartest person within this conversation.
And he has come across as the smartest person within the conversation, but I don't trust him at all. The other thing I wonder is, what did he accomplish with this contract with America?
Yeah.
We are in a worse mess now than we were then, and if they had done their job, they would have at least put us on an irrevocable track to be in a better situation. And yet we've got the entitlement program ticking time bomb going to go off at 2020 or 2025, something like that, where everything just goes broke and we become Greece. So I don't think he helped. So, you know, whenever you hear him speak, the other thing that I always hear from him is that he's always talking about making government more efficient.
Right.
Efficient. Or he'll say something
not more relevant.
He'll say something that sounds good given the context that we have now.
He says it in a tired, wise way.
Well,
like
right.
This.
But so listen, there's something that actually got the audience excited at some prior debate, which was he said, well, look, if we're going to give money for unemployment, we should make them undergo job training. Right. We shouldn't let them just sit there and collect the checks, right? That sounds great if you think about the current context where people are just taking those unemployment checks and going, ha ha, I've got two more years of this coming to me and I'm not going to do anything, and they just pretend to look for work. But it is not the government's job to provide job training.
He's taking it as a given. Yeah,
he's talking about
I'll make this bad situation better.
But the context is still big government picking winners and losers. Now the winners are the people who will go for the job training while they get their unemployment benefits, right? So, you know, we're still going to have these huge, expensive government programs. That's the context, but he'll spend it in a little bit better way. So, as I said, I think we should get Santorum, Bachman
out,
and Huntsman out. Huntsman's big government guy.
Oh, he's terrible. He worked for Obama.
He's doing terrible in the polls. One thing I wanted to emphasize a little bit more about Santorum is that that answer with respect to Pakistan, where he's putting the I wish above and it is, I think it literally is his very extreme, you know, religious
Positive.
Viewpoint that contributes to that, right? This idea that whatever is in your consciousness has some real merit. So if we say, well, look, we must be friends with Pakistan because they have nukes, and you just have that planted in your mind without any real evidence that Pakistan, you know, could actually be our friend, I think that type of mental process comes from someone who has faith in things.
Right.
You know, so there's people for whom faith is a certain part of their life. There's people for whom faith is a lot bigger part of their life. And I think that having faith as a huge part of your life could be a detriment if you're a politician in certain situations. I, for myself, it's not like I'm saying I'll vote for only atheists, but if it seems to me that the epistemological method is so imbued in somebody that they're going to put this, I wish Pakistan would be our friend above the it is, which is that they haven't been acting like anything like a friend.
They got away with hiding bin Laden for years because they're, quote, unquote, our friend.
Yeah.
We didn't go in there and look.
Yeah. So it's sad. Now, they're talking about all of the different politicians and do they demonstrate a learning curve?
In the chat room.
Yeah. We got to talk about voting strategies. This is where we got to figure out what we're going to do in 2012. And David, a listener who I think is hanging out in the chat room now, he came to my blog at don'tletitgo.com and he said, maybe it's time we start discussing some voting strategies. And for me, you know, to really kind of weigh all the pros and cons, I do want to see who actually wins the nomination. There was an expert site. They have these sites that rate the probabilities of certain things based on people betting or something.
Romney funds it.
I don't know. But they're betting 71%, at least as of the other night, that Romney's going to win the nomination. So it might be him. The other thought that occurred to me is that maybe it's going to be Gingrich Kane or Kane Gingrich. I know some people on Twitter have been calling for that. Yeah. And people tend to like Kane and respect Gingrich's knowledge, so they might try to fuse those into one ticket. In any event, so imagine who you think it might be and then consider the two options, the two following options. Dr. Michael Hurd, who I talked about earlier with respect to the Kane epistemology problem, he says we should vote for any Republican that's out there just to get rid of Obama, that it's that bad that we really have to do that. On the other hand, you have Dr. Harry Binswanger, who says the most important thing really is to recapture the Senate. It's not as important who is president, so I guess he seems open to, even if Obama is president, it's not that big a thing. So I assume maybe if Romney, who is Romney a little bit worse than Gingrich?
I'd say yes.
It was so funny because somebody tweeted out, I think it was Tony Katz. He said, so here's an informal poll, Romney or Gingrich? And he meant, which one do you like better, Romney or Gingrich? So I tweeted back, you mean which one is worse? Well, I guess Romney's worse.
That's funny.
Because that's my perspective on those two, right? So maybe it's my perspective on all of them,
that's
really.
What I'm saying. I haven't thought about it, but yeah, Gingrich is better than Romney.
Yeah, he's
I
know, I'm sorry to say that, but in my mind, I like him a bit more. So this is how my brain's working. But and you know, again, we are taking a whole bunch of incommensurable things, you know, we're putting, you know, obviously none of these guys is that great.
Absolutely not.
We're putting them all together in their mind. We're sort of exposing ourselves to as much information as possible and debate
more
after
so
debate
usual.
After debate. Oh,
I mean, more so than usual. I haven't watched debates like this ever.
But part of it's because I have this show. I mean,
yeah,
just part of it's that.
And you want to discuss.
But also part of it is because so much is at stake. And of course, the reason I have this show is because so much is at stake.
Right.
So it's a big circular
right.
argument. But, you know, we're absorbing as much as we can. And then at the end, you do kind of have a gut level reaction, but it is as a result of
accumulating
all this knowledge and trying to weigh all of these incommensurable things and keep the context. So, yeah, Gingrich just right now off the cuff strikes me as a little bit better than Romney.
Yeah, I still like Kane.
So here we go. So which do you think is better? Do you think it's better to vote for whatever Republican gets the nomination to get rid of Obama, or are you going to be picky and leave open that you might vote for Obama, if the Republican that they put in is bad enough. So let me give you some arguments pro and con, and people are already starting here in the chat room to give us some good arguments pro and con. Actually, I've got someone who just called in who wants to weigh in on this topic, so I think I'm going to do that. We have a new caller. Hi, if you can hear me, you're on the air. Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Who's this?
This is Harold in Florida.
Okay, hi.
Good. I just got just real quick scattershot here. Kane and Gingrich are both from Georgia, so they can't be on the same ticket because that's in the first page of the Constitution. It says quite clearly the president and vice president have to be from different states.
Now, so, I saw that posted on the web maybe a couple weeks ago. And well, and then I heard that one or the other of them has modified their residency in order to allow for this.
I believe so.
So I don't think so.
They haven't, so they are still both residents
but
of Georgia. And
I think that was based on that because someone did write about that.
Yeah, so someone did write in response, so we have to look that up. But you have a good point that if it's true that they're disqualified, they're not going to be able to run together. But someone had posted that maybe they had done this
prior to running
to try to take care of it.
Yeah, I see Gingrich as Kane's wingman right now. I would like to see Gingrich try to build up his support as much as he can, and then pull out and throw it all behind Kane right at the end so that they can get bigger numbers.
Well, and that could be what they're doing. You know, a lot of people have enjoyed and valued the contributions that Gingrich has made in all these debates. I sure have with respect to some of the issues, but at the same time, he's got so much baggage. And Kane, as someone who comes in as a businessman, an outsider, he's got much less baggage, but he doesn't have the firepower, you know, with respect
factor.
To some issues. But he's got the likability factor. I like his overall approach to issues. You know, when he says this is how I'm going to tackle these problems,
I
like it. I like a lot of his gut instincts or in some of the actual positions that he's taken. But I don't know. So you think that it's possible that Kane could win with Gingrich following that strategy?
Yeah, they look to me. Remember, you've got to know who Herman Kane is. He's friends with Neil Bortz. Neil Bortz, WSB Atlanta on 750 Atlanta. So they've known each other for years. Neil Bortz vouches for Herman Cain. And I think Gingrich and Cain are really friends. I mean, you see them smiling at each other in debates. They don't look like adversaries.
No, and they did
all.
That debate together as well.
Yeah, they did that one practice. Debate in a non-adversarial format as well. Yeah.
Pretty friendly.
I mean,
By the way,
would be good.
Just to change the subject, one of your other subjects from earlier today.
Sure.
When you talked about, the 5 times 0 equals still 0, I thought about that. I didn't post this, but I thought about it earlier that, Ayn Rand saying the onus of proof is on he who asserts the positive. You cannot disprove a negative because nothing has no attributes, no properties. There's nothing you can test or know about nothing except nothingness. And so it's impossible to prove your innocence because there's nothing, there's no properties that can be tested to know that you're, to prove that. The other example probably that was given a couple of years ago was by Leonard Peikoff, where he said, someone claims there's a conference of gremlins on Mars studying Hegel.
Well, were you here at the beginning of this show today? Because I was talking, I guess a couple of people had trouble connecting to the show, and maybe you were one of the ones that had trouble connecting to the show. But I said there are some gremlins working for Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah,
who have prevented
that.
All of you. Yeah, I mean, this is the same kind of assertion. But, there is nothing that emanates from the non-existence of a gremlin. You can't point to evidence of their non-existence, yeah.
Right. Just think of the example that the gremlins having a conference on Mars. How am I, as a person, supposed to disprove that? What do I have to do? Collect a couple of $1 billion, build a spaceship, go over there, take a look. I mean, it's impossible. It can't be done.
Right. Oh, by the way, Harold, I've got someone in the chat room named Oscar who says, I heard that Newt is now a resident of Virginia. So
I didn't know you could. Hey, he's mobile.
Well, I mean, you can change your residency, right? It's not like they say, well, if you're born in a certain state, then you couldn't, right? I don't believe that's what the Constitution says. right?
Yeah, you know, the way Hillary Clinton is a resident of New York now. I mean,
right.
Sure.
These things are, yeah. All right, that's all I have today.
Okay. Someone said they lost sound. I hope that there are gremlins in there. Thanks very much for calling in, Harold. Maybe there are gremlins because someone on the chat room says I lost sound at 6:20. So maybe we have evidence, real evidence that there are some gremlins in there. We are still on. We're still here. So I think other people can hear us. Otherwise, they would also.
Can someone just type in?
Oh, people are. Yeah, tell us you can hear us and that you could just hear the conversation that we had with Harold a minute ago. That would be good. Now, here's some reasons why Dr. Hurd, who's saying that we have to vote for any Republican no matter how bad, why he could be right.
It'll save us time.
Now, first of all, actually, Maya here in the chat room said one of the things that I wanted to talk about, which is that Obama typically bypasses the other branches of government on a regular basis.
Yep.
So whereas voting for gridlock used to actually get you something.
Yep.
It doesn't get you nearly as much as it used to anymore because he just says, hey, I'll do
Not
it by executive order. Yeah. So that's one important element, the executive order issue. Other problem is Obamacare.
Yep.
Obamacare needs to at least have the possibility of being repealed because it's not for sure clear to me that it's going to be invalidated by the Supreme Court when they take it up. There have been some appellate court judges in this country who have upheld Obamacare as unconstitutional, so I'm worried about that. And even Romney is on the record promising to repeal Obamacare, if he can. We'll talk about that in a minute. So there's that important thing, that Obamacare has to be out. And if we don't have somebody other than Obama as president, we don't have a chance of repealing Obamacare. Now, you could, I guess, have the override, you know, with the two-thirds majority in both.
Right.
How likely? I mean, we're going to be lucky if we have a Republican majority in the Senate, the way the Senate is so entrenched with, you know, the old boy politics or whatever. We can't count on being able to override a veto with respect to the repealing of Obamacare. So that's another argument. The third is, how about this? Sure, we'll have, you know, Republicans in the Senate, right? But which would they be?
Right.
They could be big government Republicans.
Who want to get their hands on Obamacare and
yeah.
make it their own.
Oh, yeah. You know,
we can do it better.
We just want to tweak Obamacare.
It's like in England. It's a left-leaning country, no matter who's in power.
Yeah. So even if we do take over the Senate, we're just going to get a bunch of maybe big government Republicans in the Senate. Now, that's not necessarily true, but it depends very much what type of Republicans we have in there. And we had that story that we talked a few weeks ago about the fact that when these Tea Party politicians, these brand new freshmen that come in, the GOP, the establishment GOP,
Boehner
tries
in
to
particular.
Yeah,
Boehner, who's been doing nothing.
Tries to corrupt them.
Who basically doesn't know how to speak. She's Speaker of the House, doesn't know. He's been trying to bring down the Tea Party, the new Tea Party members of the House, Tea Party them.
Mm.
Let them know how Washington really works.
Yeah. So I think that's the argument on that side. Now, the argument for what Dr. Binswanger, now I haven't read Dr. Binswanger. He has a list that he posts that you have to pay to belong to. In terms of me, what arguments I can come up with to support his view, and it's something that also Yaron Brook has said in the past, Romney goes out there, and this is something that was also one listener in the chat room talked about this earlier. Romney says he's in favor of free enterprise. He is putting himself out there as a representative of capitalism. The New York Times, I think it might have been Ryan.
Radical.
I think it was Ryan maybe who posted this, who had said that the New York Times is blaming Romney because of his radical form of capitalism. It's
unbelievable.
Just, it's garbage. I mean, I don't know how many more examples I have to give you that Romney does not represent capitalism at all. Right. I gave you a bunch of examples that's just garbage.
He's yesterday's Democrat. I mean, that's what he is.
Yeah. So if he is out there as the next representative of capitalism and we continue to see economic stagnation, recession. There, the other day I heard it called the Great Recession.
Right.
If it's a depression, just own up and call it a depression.
Right.
It's not going to make it any better by calling it the Great Recession.
I think you asked him, who's present?
So just imagine the long-term damage that could be done to the reputation of capitalism if someone like Romney is the standard bearer for capitalism. So, I mean, that is a strong argument against voting for someone like Romney. What do you think? I want to, right here. What do you think, people? Do you think that you would vote for Romney? Or would you try to vote for Obama and gridlock and for the long-term reputation
never,
of capitalism?
Can
you think of other reasons? Can you think of other reasons why we might choose to not vote for the Republican nominee other than what I put out there? Because there could be other arguments as well.
Because they stink. Because it won't be a big difference. It won't be a big difference. Then we need the anti-Obama. We don't have it right now, but at least someone. Romney's the closest to Obama on the Republican side.
Yeah, Kane is the closest to an anti-Obama who has the chance of getting elected.
That's right. And taking it to him.
Gary Johnson, poor Gary Johnson, who never got to be in these debates.
Yeah, but he's weak. No matter his value, he's weak. When he had an opportunity, he blew it every single time in the debates, on television.
Now, Michael here says that he would never vote for Romney.
I can't do that.
I don't know if I think what I would just do is not vote. I don't think I would vote for Obama,
exactly right.
But I think I just wouldn't vote. Would you vote for Gingrich Kane or Kane Gingrich? I would much prefer Kane Gingrich.
Yes.
If that happened, I would prefer Kane to be the president and calling the shots.
Absolutely right.
And Gingrich.
He could keep Gingrich.
Keep his big government policy.
Keep himself left corrupted by Gingrich's knowledge.
So who do we have here? This is our informal poll on the chat room here. So Ryan says, I think a Romney presidency is the worst possible outcome.
I do too. Because if he's to be the contrast, and he's not.
Yeah.
That would, you know.
Yeah,
he could get away with more.
Well, he kept saying his program is a stark departure from Obama. So if he says it, that makes it
that's
true,
it.
Right? Primacy of consciousness.
It's bold.
So Nolan says I would not vote for Romney. I would hope for gridlock.
I couldn't walk over to the place and actually vote for him.
Ryan says, let the current recession take its course. Wouldn't it be nice if the politicians would just let the current recession?
Exactly.
They keep talking about let the market clear. And recently, Obama, not with the help of Congress or the Senate, because he was able to do it by executive order somehow or through administrative rule or whatever, he was able to prop up mortgages, prevent foreclosures. Those need to be cleared out. If the housing market's ever going to recover, they have to clear the inventory, so to speak. So they won't let the current, with Obama, he's going to make things
worse. And Carter, and look, I like him, but as soon as he pulled out, he endorsed Romney. I don't understand.
Oh, yeah.
He's,
why
he's
did
like a Tea Party.
That, Batten, you have to answer that. You have to answer that, Batten.
I mean,
maybe
very likable
you should call up and talk to us, Batten, and answer that. Why would Thaddeus McCotter endorse Romney, of all people?
It was like, what?
Yeah, Michael says Johnson has good positions, but he's a marshmallow in person.
He's
got great positions on economic issues, not so great on foreign policy. He wasn't quite as bad as Ron Paul.
He's soft Ron Paul.
Yeah,
who the hell wants that?
Soft Ron Paul. Cloud says, I'll be pleased if we have elections in 2012. I think I've heard that from Cloud before. Nolan says on the Kane Gingrich type ticket would be infinitely better than Obama. So, of course.
Yeah. If that's a choice. Yeah.
Dan says, and I've recently learned what FTW means in the chat room here. We have a Kane Gingrich FTW, yes, for the win. Ron Paul for a second Holocaust.
True. And what about Ron Paul? This is true. If we got news, you'd be like, well, we shouldn't have been there. I mean, that's what he would say. 9/11 was because we shouldn't have been there. If we get nuked, what? Same thing.
Kane Gingrich wouldn't be horrible if Gingrich conservatism was restrained. Yep. And then Maya says it's going to be her first election as a citizen. She says, I won't stay home. If it's Romney, I'm sorry, but I'll vote for him. You know, in your situation, Maya, I think I could excuse that.
It's
not that I would blame you. And here's the thing. We are in such a bad situation right now. It's not like I'm saying, okay, this is the right answer, and if you don't like my answer, then you're completely wrong. Again, we're dealing with the information as we have it now.
Yeah.
We don't have ballots in front of us now, thankfully. I am with Cloud. I'm going to be very happy to see that ballot in front of me. I'm going to be happy to see that there aren't any irregularities in the voting in 2012. There's all these things to worry about as well.
They've had 3 or 4 years to scheme. Who knows?
I don't know. But, yeah.
But you know what? Romney, it's like Mick Romney this time. That's where I see it. The same stinking choice that we had last time.
Ryan says Obama is putting makeup on the economy and Kane will have to remove it.
That's pretty good.
And that will make, I mean, here's the thing. If people don't keep the context, the next president could look a little bad because he's going to be for, hopefully, imposing some austerity measures, so to speak, cutting some spending and not putting these Band-Aids or camouflage or makeup over the problems. Batten says, don't underestimate the 2012 election. He says, the nation is changing rapidly and the rules by the powers that be are being rejected by the people of every ideology. He says, don't despair. So Batten is the eternal optimist.
This is still America, no matter what the hell we're seeing. But,
but look, he is. Batten agrees that it is disappointing that Thaddeus McCotter and George Romney.
I like McCotter. I like him. He's a Tea Party guy, so I don't get it.
Now, what do you have to do to stand for president of the United States, asks Oscar. So he must be from elsewhere. I don't think you have to have any particular job qualifications. You have to be born in the United States, right? You have to be above 35.
You breathe. I think you have to breathe.
You do. Yeah, you have to breathe.
Okay.
And apparently you should be able to communicate in a lot of debates.
Yeah.
Now,
you
have to declare by a certain time and fill out forms, and there's probably, you know, different logistical restrictions that you have to do as well, but there's not, you know, you don't have to be a politician.
You don't have to be smart. You don't have to be smart.
You don't have to take an IQ test.
No.
You don't even have to take a lie detector test.
You don't have to be honest.
No. I mean, hopefully you have to be honest.
No.
Now, what we should do is about one thing, and this may increase the stakes for you, Obamacare. I heard this week about another provision of Obamacare that is truly horrible. And the article is on foxnews.com. It was written by Ronald Rotunda, R-O-T-U-N-D-A, if you want to go ahead and search on foxnews.com. The article is called, Does Obamacare as Written Prevent Congress from Repealing It? Did you hear that? Does Obamacare as Written Prevent Congress from Repealing It? That sounds terrible. So what is he talking about? He says, well, several courts have invalidated parts of Obamacare because of the individual mandate. And we've talked about that on the show numerous times. The individual mandate, recall, requires people to buy a particular form of insurance. He says, but that is not the only constitutional problem with Obamacare. He says, soon the other shoe is about to drop. Another section actually limits the power of Congress to repeal an essential part of this law. That restriction, an unheralded but fatal flaw, provides yet another reason why the law must be unconstitutional. And he says, a case in Arizona, which is called Coons versus Geithner, Timothy Geithner, I assume, is challenging the Independent Payment Advisory Board, IPAB. Its result will add another stake into the heart of Obamacare. Now, what is the Independent Payment Advisory Board? Say that 12 times fast. It is going to, in effect, dictate how much payments they can give to providers who take Medicare and Medicaid. And it starts in 2013, and they have the actuaries, and they make their little calculations. And, in effect, what this board does is legislate such that certain things become law at that point because of this advisory board without Congress giving them any additional help. And that's wrong. Legislation should be preserved for Congress. The panel is going to cut payments and, in effect, legislate automatically on certain things. The stickler with this is that under the Obamacare legislation, in the part that talks about the creation of this IPAB, there is a very limited window of time in which they can repeal that provision and get rid of the IPAB and all of its various rulings. And it's really weird. It's like this very short window. It says they have to have a joint resolution. It has to be phrased in a particular way, and it has to be introduced between January 3rd and February 1st of 2017. And it takes a lot more than a simple majority to pass the resolution. It has to be 60% of all elected members of each House of Congress, whether or not they are present. They have to vote in favor. And, you know, sometimes they aren't even there. and they have to do so no later than August 15th, 2017. So they have to introduce it in this particular window, and they have to pass it with this huge majority before August 15th, 2017. And then it says, even then, IPAB must continue to exist until 2020, no matter what Congress says. So in effect, in this legislation, they've put this huge board in with massive powers and said they're going to make it, according to parliamentary procedure, out of order to introduce a resolution to get rid of it, unless it's introduced in this particular window, and then they have to also pass the resolution by a huge majority. So they're putting in the legislation, they put in the legislation something that makes it almost impossible to get rid of, given the realities of the political process. I mean, imagine how entrenched Obamacare is going to be by 2017 if right now it's like you have to go out of your way to get the GOP candidates to promise to repeal it.
Say anything about it.
It's like it was like pulling teeth to get Romney to say, yes,
that's
I will repeal it. They during one debate, a couple debates ago, they pressed it.
When was the last time you said Obamacare, Boehner?
Yeah, I mean, that was one thing that puzzled me about this, though, is that didn't they introduce legislation and pass legislation in the House saying that they wanted to repeal it? Of course, it then went nowhere.
Right.
The Senate didn't pass it. And
he said something concretely. He said, we will. And he hasn't said anything. He's been busy trying to bring in the Tea Party.
He can't do it now.
I know, no, but
right.
He could talk about it. Keep it out there.
Yeah.
Talk
but,
about
but
it.
But my guess
out.
Is that,
make some noise.
My guess is that a lot of the legislators didn't even know this was in here.
Probably not. You're right.
And this is like a little time bomb waiting to go off. Now, who says, what about the effect of presidential election to the Supreme Court? Oh, in terms, okay, so that could be part of the argument. Pooja is talking in the chat room here about the fact that if a certain president is elected, he gets to appoint members of the Supreme Court. So that could be an issue.
Oh, yeah.
And if Obama continues to be able to appoint justices of, you know, the living constitution variety, and the altruist, entrenched socialism variety, that could be that as well. So that might be another reason to adopt Dr. Hurd's.
So that's the source again for this.
Oh, yeah. The source again for this article is foxnews.com. And you should search for the name Rotunda, R-O-T-U-N-D-A, to get this article. He says, we might think that a court will jump in to save us, but Obamacare has thought of that as well. He says, the statute that creates this independent payment advisory board, the statute that creates it, also forbids any and all judicial review. Can you believe this?
Absolutely.
I mean, this seems like something you read on WorldNet Daily, not the truth. You know, when I posted this on the Facebook earlier this week, I said, this is worse than anything that Ayn Rand actually put in Atlas Shrugged.
Right.
Because there, you know, the legislation was truly awful, but she didn't imagine in her mind all of the weird tricks of parliamentary procedure and limiting jurisdiction and all the stupid things that they've been, I mean, stupid. I guess you'd say they're smart, but you'd say they're smart in the way that Hitler was smart, you know,
that's
that he was devious. This is Rotunda continuing here. As one supporter of IPAB enthused, the decision of the Department of Health and Human Services to implement an IPAB proposal is absolutely immune from judicial review, end quote. Congress gave, quote unquote, breathtaking discretion to the IPAB, then abdicated its powers and finally excluded any role for the courts. So this panel that's going to have huge control over the amount of spending on healthcare in this country is going to be free from oversight by Congress and immune from judicial review, says Rotunda. He says, Abbott supporters liken the IPAB to a benevolent dictator or platonic guardian. He says, but the framers of our Constitution did not embrace platonic guardians. He says, the Federalist Papers, number 49, specifically reject, quote, the philosophical race of kings wished for by Plato, end quote. Instead, we choose democracy and judicial review. Obamacare does not. End quote. So that's Ron Rotunda. And someone's got the link in the chat room so you guys can check it all out.
Thanks, Michael.
So this is another reason that we need somebody good in the White House. I mean, this is your question, right? We always talk about balancing, buying time so that we can convert the culture to something better, and at the same time not doing that in a way that undermines the education component of the battle with the culture, right? So we don't want Romney out there as the, you know, representative, the standard bearer for capitalism and free enterprise. And if the New York Times is already putting that label on him, just wait, you know, until he's actually president. Yes, there is the alternative media, and I'm a, you know, happy part of the alternative media coming out here trying to get my voice heard. But I don't have the kind of numbers that the New York Times. I like that kind of traffic, right? I want that
kind of
traffic, so we can get the truth out. So that's, I mean, we're between a rock and a hard place with this because we need
the rock and a hard place.
A Barack and a hard place. Ha 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 ha. We need to do something so that we do have this time to continue to educate the culture. At the same time, we don't want to undermine our long-term efforts at education by supporting someone who's just going to ruin the reputation of capitalism further than it already
is. They tried to blame the last 8 years, you know, Bush years on capitalism, as if that was capitalism.
Yeah. So this is depressing. I don't know quite what the answer is. I tend to think that Obamacare is so bad and that his usurpations of the power that he, you know,
no matter if he doesn't even win, if that's not repealed, he will have won forever in this country. I mean,
well, and that's the question. Will he have won forever? I think he will have succeeded in getting socialized medicine.
Yes, no, but in turning this country, flipping it far more left than ever would have been by nature, I mean, by the nature of the country itself.
Yeah.
And that is a victory that the left has wanted for over 100 years. You know.
So what? So our hope is just a little bit better than despair.
Yeah.
We are, I guess, hoping for a Kane Gingrich-ish.
Right now, based on these debates.
Based on what is realistically possible.
On the fact that Kane is less corrupt than his fellow politicians running right now. Based on the fact that Gingrich has said some damn good stuff.
Limited context.
Yeah. Right now, yeah, they are the two best.
So that's what I have to say. The only other story that I did want to talk about. Oh, we have a call. I think we should take it.
Yeah.
This would be very good. Hi, you're on, if you can hear me. Can you hear me?
Hi. This is Luke Murphy.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I sure can.
Okay. I really agree with what you're saying about Romney and about his effect on the culture, and I wanted to add a little bit more about that. The way I see it is just that in these last 4 years, we've gotten this incredible momentum towards moving the culture further towards capitalism, more than, as far as I know, this country's ever had before in the last 50 years or so. And that is largely in response to Obama.
Right.
And I think as soon as we elect Romney, it's over. I really think it would just be over. I don't think that wave of sort of love or more attention towards free market ideas that we have now would continue after Romney's president, because everybody's going to look at it and the disastrous results and say,
right,
okay, you got it. You got what you wanted, and now
right,
this is what we have.
Now, do you think the better elements of the Tea Party would call him out as much as they would call out an Obama, or do you think it would be the usual fall behind the Republican simply because he's a Republican?
Well, I hope they would. I think there's more people today who would do that than there were 4 years ago.
Right.
But I don't know if it's enough to keep the Tea Party movement growing and growing right direction.
There's so many unknowns. And then the question you have to balance that against is, how much damage would having Obamacare not be invalidated or repeal do on that long-term battle as well?
Yeah. It has to be.
What do you think, Luke? Because I mean, he has promised to repeal it. Do we take Romney at his word that he would repeal it,
and then at the same time
take the fact that the culture's moved enough, you know, that we'll do
who's
it.
Who's going to repeal Romneycare?
Yeah.
You know?
You get the last word, Luke, because we're going to have to end the show real quick. What do you say?
Well, I don't trust Romney enough to repeal it and replace it with nothing, or replace it with something that actually scales back Medicare and Medicaid. I think it's going to be something nearly as bad as Obamacare. With Romney, I'd really vote for any other Republican except him, and probably except Perry, but he's got no chance at this point anyway.
No.
So.
Yeah, I think he shot himself in the foot, unfortunately.
Romney's the least Republican. He is. He's the most like Obama. That's why he has to get knocked out.
Okay, well, thanks very much for calling in. We love having the first-time callers. We got to go now pretty quick. I'm going to remind you, go to my blog at don'tletitgo.com during the week to keep up with everything that I'm doing. I did have my bio, my review of the Steve Jobs bio, published at PJ Media last week, so go check it out if you haven't yet. I have a link to it on my blog. There are also at my blog all the other ways to get in touch with me. The links to my page on Facebook. I have a Don't Let It Go Unheard page on Facebook. I've got a bit about the Ayn Rand bot there. If you're not following the Ayn Rand bot on Twitter, maybe follow that. And I've got also my Twitter if you want to follow me personally. And next time there's a debate, you can see all my rants live. So thank you very much again. And we will be back here. Actually, this time we're going to be in 2 weeks. I'm sorry, I'm going to be taking next week off as an early Thanksgiving break. Thank you. Have a good evening. Good night.